cocaine is being produced at greater quantities than ever.
Invisibles are the future of the cocaine trade. They don't want a gold-plated Uzi. They don't want to touch a kilo of cocaine. They've realized their best protection is just not being on anyone's radar at all.
We see a kilo of cocaine wholesale between $180,000 to $300,000.
The same quantity in the US would go for $25,000.
That's the issue with Australia. It's always the issue with Australia. The price for a kilo of cocaine is astronomical.
We command the highest prices in the world. So therefore, they will use whatever mode they can to bring those drugs into Australia.
He's a puppet master, someone that thrived on power, on money, on influence.
He was an invisible boss. He was an email address, he was a pseudonym, he was a phone number, he was a voice down the end of the phone. No one knew exactly who he was.
He epitomizes what everybody has in their mind of a supervillain.
It's a brilliant mind working with the worst of the worst around the world. And it made me even hungrier to want him off the playing field. The boat is capsized off an island in Tonga.
This vessel, the Giravé, was well battered. A male had been located on board who was deceased.
Tongan Navy, along with the AFP, found 204 kilos of cocaine on the boat.
We were provided with documentation which confirmed Ivan Vaklovich was a skipper. Milan Rinzek, a Slovakian citizen, was also on board. The clearance paperwork, they declared their ultimate destination is Sydney, Australia.
There was one body that was decomposed on the boat that we found. And the other body, I don't know where he went. There's all types of stories about what happened.
How did they end up in this predicament?
Whatever happened to Captain Ivan and his first mate?
LaRue was the biggest Australian criminal that we've never heard of.
Paul LaRue was incredibly anxious to have a massive cocaine operation going on in Australia. He thought he was untouchable.
Can you spell out for us why you'd want us to take cocaine to Australia?
Huge profit margin.
Narcos would perceive the Australian market as an extremely lucrative place to send their cocaine.
If you're looking at how much it costs in the US, $87 a gram to buy cocaine compared to $300 a gram here in Australia, it does go to show you that there's a significant profit margin differential.
Because it is so hard to get it in and we are so far away, that drives the price up and the demand is there and people will pay it.
Australia is a gold mine for cocaine traffickers.
Given the dominant prices that we command, the invisibles behind all this, they will use any means if they think they're going to get it through.
La idea era enviar un semisumergible, digamos, desde Ecuador, íbamos a enviarlo, saliendo de Ecuador, que atravesara todo el Pacífico hasta llegar a Australia. Porque los semisumergibles tenían capacidad para estar un mes en el agua.
If you're a business guy and you have a kilogram of cocaine to sell in America for 25 grand or sell in Australia for 300 grand, what are you going to do?
LaRue is no doubt thinking when he looks at Australia that he is going to make a lot of money. He's the eternal businessman, if he can open up that pipeline or that drug stream to Australia and get that regular flow, ultimately he's going to be the winner.
Paul LaRue initially was born in Rhodesia. During the white flight from Rhodesia, he ended up in South Africa during the Mugabe takeover.
By all accounts, he was the kind of kid that would close his door at the end of the school day and sit on the computer. He wasn't out with his friends every afternoon.
Very, very bright. I believe he was a high school dropout, but he was fascinated with technology.
He showed a great interest in computer programming, and that more or less dictated the rest of his life.
He was self-taught. That's the uniqueness of Paul and the brilliance of Paul. He wasn't taught a method. He just did it.
He's been waiting much of his teenage life to escape that middle-class upbringing in South Africa. All of a sudden, he's got the opportunity and he takes it. He moves to London, he's talented with computers, and he finds work as a software programmer. And he comes across this Australian girl who's on holidays in London. They form a connection, which turns romantic. Eventually, he follows her back to Australia. He moves to Sydney, he finds a way to continue his software programming, and he forms an Australian company.
And he was married to an Australian woman and gained status in Australia based upon that marriage.
Where they're living, it's not glamorous. It's a two-story yellow brick unit in Belmore in Sydney's west. By day, he's working as an on-contract software programmer. But at nighttime, he's working on a secret project, which is a military-grade encryption program. This is software that locks up every file on a computer and stops any government agency from accessing it.
They called it encryption for the masses, is what it was, E4M. I guess you would call Paul kind of a privacy anarchist type. He didn't believe the government had the right to look at people's private emails, etc. Everybody likes to categorize Paul. They call him the fat geek and all this kind of stuff. Paul is far from a fat geek. Paul is a brilliant individual who has a personality like a Fortune 500 CEO.
But at that point in his life, LaRue hates Australia. He hates Australians. He hates the welfare system. He hates the attitude of Australians. He hates the way Australians see themselves in the world. He criticises any chance he gets online.
Australia could disappear into the Pacific, and the only difference it would make is the Americans would have one less pussy country to protect.
Going on discussion board forums, enraging every Australian on the forums. He creates a campaign of hate against him.
Australia had too much law and structure for Paul. Paul needed a bit of lawlessness to thrive.
He was scathing of Australia's laws, and I think that caused him to move offshore.
He ultimately divorced that woman and then found his way to the Philippines.
Any successful transnational organized crime boss has corruption involvement at the highest levels of the government, period. So Paul LaRue, he knew he can get away with a lot in the Philippines.
He discovered he was adopted. For him, that was heartbreaking. He had absolutely no idea. And he took it really badly. His view of the world and his life changed. At that point, LaRue starts talking about a business venture that he's setting up in the US.
The US is a pill market, okay? You can see it today, even with the opioid crisis. US people want to, you know, take a pill, make me skinny. Take a pill, get my hard. Take a pill, take a pill. Paul foresaw all that. He was ahead of his time, and he had thought this out very well.
So he was brilliant in far as how he set up his company called RX Limited, this illegal pharmaceutical business to sell pills on the internet that were being distributed all over America and making hundreds of millions of dollars.
Paul LaRue was trafficking in tramadol, Viagra, oxycodone, all sorts of pharmaceutical substances where they had doctors on the payroll and the doctors would take incoming calls and go, okay, I'll give you 20 pills of Viagra without ever seeing the individual.
He knew that U.S. law enforcement would not be that concerned with Schedule 4 drugs and non-controlled substances. Even though people were dying and even though people were getting addicted, he knew it wasn't going to create a lot of attention.
He was making approximately $9 million a month on online pharmacy operations alone.
Profit.
Some estimates put the income of RX Limited at about $200 million a year, which is phenomenal. Now, he's not keeping that money. He's investing it elsewhere. He's looking at where he can make a profit.
He had conquered the RX Limited thing in his mind. He had conquered pharmaceuticals. Okay, what's next? The time now was for Paul to take to the next level. Basically, he was like a one-man crime enterprise in the Philippines, and he had his tentacles everywhere in the world.
He starts looking at forestry concessions, at gold mining, at diamonds. He starts looking at a whole range of commodities where there's very little laws.
He was involved in getting meth out of North Korea, in the illegal transport of weapons, purchasing weapons out of India. He was in business with Iran to create a missile guidance system, but he also was looking to obtain weapons directly from Iran. There was really nothing that Paul did not have his hands in.
LaRue was pretty much one guy sitting in a room with a laptop, controlling hundreds of other people. Few people knew the extent of his criminal empire.
He also had a team of U.S. mercenaries who worked for him committing violence in order to secure and protect his operations. The leader of the mercenary team was Joseph Rambo Hunter. Joseph Hunter was a former U.S. military, U.S. Army.
Obviously, he had years of experience in the military, and then when he left the military, he wanted to make some big money, and he chose the mercenary route to work for this madman, Paul LaRue.
Joseph Hunter had cultivated a group of mercenaries to work for him. Western-trained soldiers, which made them all the more dangerous, too, because it wasn't just some, you know, Filipino street thug. It wasn't some low-level guy. They had military guys planning these operations to kill and hurt people.
LaRue was involved in a boatload of guns, Indonesian-made assault rifles that were captured by the Philippines authorities, and the boat captain who sailed that ship turns up dead. Two other people end up dead.
Everybody associated with the seizure of those arms all got killed. Very cold-blooded. He could kill his best friend tomorrow if he felt he was cheated and not have any real remorse. That's if Paul LaRue really ever had a best friend, because I don't believe he did.
He was playing a little bit of a mind game. You know, he was trying to see how much he can do, how much he can get away with. So we wanted to put the best and brightest that the DEA had to get this guy.
My name's Tommy Singer. When I first got to the Special Operations Division, I had came there after being a police officer and DEA agent domestically for 18, 20 years. So for me, I was taking a fresh look at everything.
The Special Operations Division's primary focus is to go after the biggest and baddest threats that are out there causing havoc and chaos to communities across the world and put them in jail and have them face the rule of law and justice in America.
Myself and Eric Stouch worked together as partners, and we were operating in Africa. That was kind of my beat, was Africa. So we met with this former military attaché. He had expertise on things in Somalia because he was very much involved in the whole pirating at the time that was going on off the coast of East Africa. He emailed me a UN report that showed that Paul LaRue was running a 220-man militia in Somalia. And he shifted to wanting to do coca cultivation, opium cultivation, and methamphetamine production in Somalia. He brought in horticulturists, and he deemed it was possible to do it, but he also deemed it wasn't cost-effective to do it. What he then did do, though, is he decided that he wanted to deal with trying to fight against Al-Shabaab and take over the weapons trade. I was like, look, if this guy did half of this stuff, we got a real target.
I'm not afraid to say, hey, this was like a first. Like, never came across the guy that actually had so much connectivity to bad guys around the world.
So we spoke to our counterpart in South Africa, and he had run LaRue's name by the intelligence community, and they had provided us a tip. The particular individual had provided them extensive information regarding Paul LaRue, and that he had left his number and email address. I was like, what the f***? And I just started dialing the number. This individual picked up the phone, Jack. I said, hi, my name's Tommy Sindrick. I'm from the United States government. You have provided information regarding Paul LaRue. Are you interested in talking to us? He says, yes. Are you willing to meet with us? He said, yes. And it ultimately broke open the case. Jack was an individual who had worked in the LaRue organization. He was intimately involved in certain businesses on his behalf, legal businesses initially. And then Jack, as he started seeing the legal businesses go in the legal direction, got very nervous and wanted to turn away. He basically laid out that LaRue was a worldwide criminal operating at a level that very few people truly knew or truly understood. Jack's life was under threat at one time from Paul. He had maintained this good relationship with Paul, but he worried that at some time that could change. So he believed that the only way to protect himself was to help put Paul LaRue in jail. Myself and Eric Stouch became more and more convinced that Jack was the right person to infiltrate the LaRue organization.
The heat's coming on LaRue in the Philippines. He's getting reports from people he's corrupted within the Philippine law enforcement agencies, that the DEA are looking at him, that the Australian Federal Police is showing an interest in him. And LaRue decides to leave, and he sets himself up in Brazil.
Paul established himself in places that he knew where he would have a strong chance of not being extradited. And what he did is he actually impregnated a woman in Brazil, had a child, and quote unquote created an anchor baby. so that he could not be extradited should he be arrested by U.S. authorities in Brazil.
LaRue looks like a supervillain. He's running meth, he's running guns, he has a private militia, he has heavily armed and well-trained former army commandos at his disposal. But one of the few illegal activities that he hasn't yet been involved in is cocaine.
Paul wanted to get into cocaine in order to be the narco-like Pablo Escobar. So that is what Paul attempted to do. What we learned from the wiretaps of Paul was the identification of the boat, the MV Jerive. These guys would load the cocaine in Peru and then take this boat all the way across the Pacific.
The DEA, they believe it's heading to Australia. They tip off Australian law enforcement agencies.
My name's Dave Craft. I'm a federal agent with the Australian Federal Police. In August 2012, the DEA provided information to the AFP that a vessel of interest, the Jerave, was intending to make a shipment of cocaine to Australia. It was part of a wider investigation into Paul LaRue and his wider syndicate and activities. LaRue was looking to establish a cocaine route to Australia from Ecuador. This vessel, the Jerave, was the first vessel that was going to be utilised under that syndicate. He was looking to provide a vessel every 6 weeks. LaRue is a holder of an Australian passport and lived in Australia for an amount of time in the late 90s. He knew the markup in price that he could make for getting cocaine to Australia. Once he came up with an idea or a venture, he would go into it wholeheartedly. He was someone that wanted things done quickly and he wanted it done succinctly. The Jerave was conveyed down to Panama. The skipper, who was Ivan Vaklovich, would be tasked with moving the vessel through the Panama Canal down to Ecuador. The Ecuadorian Navy boarded the vessel and did their compliance work. We were provided with photos of documentation, everything from on board the vessel. Part of that were the passports of the two occupants. There was a level of confidence by both Vaklovich and Rinzak before they left the port. They posed with customs agents. They were extremely relaxed in their dealings with them. That indicated to us that there were no drugs on board at the time that they left the port.
The Ecuadorian Navy, they placed a tracker on the boat.
The Jerave departed Ecuador on the 20th of August. Through their clearance paperwork that they declared their ultimate destination or their final destination is Sydney, Australia. They went west for a short period of time before heading south. We believe the vessel stopped off the coast of Peru, where it met up with another vessel where the cocaine was loaded on board. There was a tracking device on board and we were getting live locational feeds off that device on a regular basis. We just had no Australian-based intelligence as to where the drugs were going to go, so we looked for opportunities to disrupt this operation offshore. The best case scenario is that we locate the vessel at a stop point along the way, interdict the vessel, arrest those on board and seize the cocaine. Worst case scenario is that we don't locate the vessel, that we miss the vessel, that it meets a daughter vessel off the coast of Australia, exchanges those drugs to another unknown vessel and we miss it.
In South America, he's an outsider. He's someone who's not a known quantity and it's very hard for him to break through and to get on the inside of the cocaine trade.
Paul was looking to obtain cocaine and we came up with the plan to introduce a Colombian and a cocaine deal. The Colombian boss was a DEA source. He fit a look that Paul would be intrigued by of a Colombian boss. He was a tall, good-looking, salt-and-peppered hair, mid-40 Colombian. Paul 100% revered the Colombian drug dealers. He liked the idea of the top boss, the Pablo Escobar, the guy sitting on top of the throne. And so we wanted to give him that guy. He felt that by having this Colombian connection, he could obtain cocaine from the Colombians, and in exchange, he would provide meth. What they agreed to was a straight swap, 100 kilos of meth for 100 kilos of cocaine. Jack explained to Paul that Colombians, they need a boss-to-boss meeting before business is consummated, okay? Paul got that. He understood that. Paul agreed to that meeting.
We picked Liberia because we had previous successes working with the Liberian officials. The president of Liberia was very, very pro-DEA and was very interested in working a joint operation with us on this case. This one, I wanted to go on. I wanted to see firsthand, you know, what would happen on the ground in Liberia and how this whole thing played out. So we planned where we got a chartered flight, flew down into Liberia, landed late in the night, and set up the operation once on the ground in Liberia with the other DEA agents.
So myself and Eric Stouch get on the ground. We get everything lined up with the Liberians. You can indict anybody sometimes, right? But can you grab them? And that's where this kind of ratcheted up the intensity. This was the coup de grace for us. Paul doesn't show up when he's supposed to. It was a very tense time. If he doesn't get on that plane, we have him indicted, but all that works for nothing at this point. So ultimately, we find out after being on the ground for about 2.5-3 weeks, Paul's coming. I saw him when he got to the hotel parking lot and watched him head in. That was the first time we had laid eyes on him firsthand. He looked like a big rugby player. He was definitely a guy who was not impressed by clothes, impressed by jewelry. He was in a pair of shorts, a polo shirt, and a pair of flip-flops. Jack takes him in and gets him settled for the evening. The plan is for the next day for Paul to have a meeting with the Colombian boss. When he comes back to the hotel room, our plan is to arrest him.
Hey, greetings. Greetings. How are you? Let me just get some drinks. You want a drink?
Water's fine.
What we're most interested in, I need as much as you can supply. Okay? As much as you can supply. We have at least a demand for 200 units a month to 1,000 units a month. That's all there.
Yeah. All good, my friend. I love you. Mommy Don, he told me to call him. He sent his driver, and driver brings us to him. We basically have a talk and introduce you to him. I call him Pepe. Pepe, yeah, because in Spanish, that means boss. Just play a little bit of the game, you know? He's very respectful, and so I want to be respectful to him as well. So I just call him Pepe.
The other thing we will need to talk to him about.
Mm-hmm.
when the first vessels come here, okay, these are like $2 million each. We need it picked up. We don't want to pull into one of these ports.
No, you can go out.
He's got a small boat to pull and deliver and take. Yeah? Delivery will be on the water.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
But the Americans, they're not on the ground, but they're always looking.
Yeah.
No. Always.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're right. But I think she is okay. Very well.
Everything is sweet. Everything is sweet.
I'll give you a call as soon as I know when the wife is here.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay. Very good.
All good.
During that meeting with the Colombian boss, Paul basically gave his resume, talked about having killed opposition, was very forthright and open about everything. They conclude the meeting. Jack takes Paul back to his hotel room. And then with the Liberians, we decide we're going to go effect the arrest.
What they did was they knocked on the door, tried to get him to come to the door, and they had to identify themselves as room service.
As we make entry, Paul immediately goes into defensive. You can tell it completely caught him off guard. No, you're not going to put me under arrest. No.
Sir, what you doing? Take it back. No, under arrest. You're not putting me under arrest. Stop resisting.
I think he's trying to figure out how two dumb cops actually were able to catch somebody as smart as him. Paul's screaming like a madman. No f*** yous, no go to hell, just screaming. Finally, the Liberian goes, sir, put your hands behind your back. You are under arrest or I will shoot you.
I think I'll shoot you.
We're all like, oh no, because in Africa, arrests go from 0 to 60. There's no escalation of force in Africa. So finally, everything calms down. We get him handcuffed. We secure the evidence. He starts immediately trying to bribe the police officers. He's going, my African brother, how can we work this out? And he wouldn't even look at me. He wouldn't look at any of the other DEA agents. He would only focus on them, and he was trying to get them to let him go.
He learned at some point he was going back to America to face justice. He wasn't happy about that.
Paul laughs and says, I'm going to apologize in advance. I'm not getting on that plane. What? He goes, I'm not getting on that plane.
I heard him yelling. He didn't want to go back. He felt like it was a kidnapping.
It takes not only all the agents, but about 6 Liberians to carry him down 3 flights of stairs. We're getting pressed up into the van. One Liberian goes, shut the door. And he shoves him in. I'm telling you, it's like 10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag. Paul is like twisted and turned, pressed against the door, can't sit down. And we're just like, we're going to the airport like this. Paul breaks into hysterics. And he goes, I did apologize in advance. I told you I wasn't getting on the plane.
As the head of this operation, I was concerned about one thing only. We were going back on this jet, and this guy, 300 pounds, gonna break bad and charge to the cockpit that had no cockpit door. So I was afraid, like, this guy's gonna try to take over the plane.
He was told to behave himself on the plane or that he would probably be thrown off the plane, okay, at 35,000 feet. I'm being facetious, but, you know, we were tired of the antics at that point. Everybody's just happy to get on the plane. He decides to be agreeable then. We sit him in a chair on the plane, and he becomes the chairman of the board. The time now was for Paul to negotiate the best deal possible.
Based off the tracking of the vessel, the path it was taking, the weather conditions, we believed it was going to make a stop in the northern area of the Cook Islands. We identified a possible area that we thought it might go, which was a place called Penryn Island, which was a small atoll. One of our concerns when we looked at that area was that it had an airstrip. You look at the options. Is this a case of the vessel simply arriving at a location, unloading to another vessel, or potentially to an aircraft? So myself and a member of the Australian Border Force travelled to the Cook Islands to coordinate a possible interdiction. Unfortunately, the vessel just didn't arrive. We're no longer getting locational data as to where the vessel may be.
Captain Ivan found the tracker, and he tossed the tracker off the boat.
Did the vessel meet with another vessel that we weren't aware of? Did it go to another location that we didn't suspect? There's a multitude of things running through our minds at that time. We were baffled as to what had happened.
He decided to come fully aboard, as we call joining Team America, right? And he wanted to cooperate with the government. So one of the questions on my mind, hey, Paul, what the hell happened with that vessel?
After the arrest of Paul, he made a call in an effort to locate where the boat was. Couldn't get hold of Ivan, couldn't get hold of anybody on the boat. So he called Ivan's wife. She said that they were got by the fishmen. We never were able to determine who the fishmen was. The working hypothesis on this is that maybe they got interdicted by pirates.
We got a message that the Tongan Navy had located the vessel washed ashore at an atoll in Tonga. A male had been located on board who was deceased. And that person on board was Milan Rinzak. A load of 204 kilos of cocaine was located, secreted underneath the bunk in the forward cabin in a purpose-built hide. We were wondering what happened to Vaclavich. You know, how did they end up in this predicament?
But the odd thing was, if they were interdicted by pirates, they would have searched that boat and found those kilos and taken them. So we really don't know the mystery behind the MV Jerif and who the fishmen were and whatever happened to Captain Ivan and his first mate. LaRue told myself that he believed that if anybody was going to survive, it was going to be Captain Ivan, that he was a survivor. And after the seizure of the MV Jerif, we saw on TV that some guy showed up saying that he had been thrown overboard out in the Pacific and survived. Eric Stouch and I are at breakfast discussing this and we're laughing, but we're like, is this possible? We pull it up on the internet. And Paul looks at the picture and he goes, it's not Captain Ivan. To this day, we really don't know what happened.
If you look at some of the images from when they first left, they were very buoyant in their photographs. And then towards the end, they were, you know, almost weather-beaten and downcast. We know that a quantity of cocaine was on board the vessel. I think if you look at a journey of this length, obviously boredom sets in. My belief is that simply that they took part in some of the drugs that were on board. Obviously, the effects of cocaine, especially of high purity, have the potential to not only cause cardiac arrest, but possibly hallucinations. That may account for some of the disjointed and bizarre conversations that Vaclavich may have had with his wife, that he'd been taken by the fishermen. I believe that they probably partook in some of the cocaine. As a result, they both died. When the vessel has ultimately come to rest on the reef and on its side, Rinczak, the fact that his body was located in the wheel well, this caused his body to stay on board, the fact that he was in the steering well of the vessel. I believe that Vaclavich's body has become dislodged and been lost at sea.
As a result of Paul's working with myself and Eric Stouch, we created a scenario to arrest Joseph Hunter and the mercenary team. We decided to throw out an opportunity for them to kill a mythical DEA agent and mythical DEA source. And we actually used, which is kind of amusing, the backdrop of the Jareve as one of the reasons for them being killed. Hunter believed that there's no way people died and just left 204 kilos. It had to be a law enforcement operation, so we let them believe that. So we used that scenario to create these two guys that needed to be killed on behalf of the Colombians and Paul.
We set up this complex multi-country operation in Thailand, Estonia, and Liberia.
So all in all, we had 10 people arrested, 3 continents, 9 hours. I still am amazed that we were able to pull off that coordination. Paul LaRue is a Rubik's Cube. He's complicated, he's multifaceted. He could be gregarious and affable in one hand, and then the next day, that could be a total spin, and he could be the most dangerous man you'd ever meet. He is the pinnacle of the cases I've done in my career. I don't think I would ever get the opportunity to arrest another Paul LaRue or anybody of his significance.
Paul LaRue wanted to be one of those drug lords. He wanted to be one of those kingpins, wanted to be someone of influence, whether that be in Africa or whether that be in Asia or whether that be in Australia. I think it was just an ultimate goal. He wanted to be one of those big players.
Paul LaRue was like the typical James Bond villain, right? Anytime he could beat the government, anytime he can make more money, it excited him. The guy was very, you know, global in nature, but he also sat behind his computer with a sophisticated technology and did all his business. Law enforcement must start embracing the Paul LaRue types, because there's more and more of them out there with the same motives, the same methods of beating the system.
Everything is sweet.